1982 film called Koya Anaskatsi. The film's title means life out of balance in the Hopi language. And there's no dialogue or narration in the film, only cinematography that juxtaposes scenes of natural beauty with scenes of increasingly intense human development and industrialization and the environmental impacts from those. And the score was composed by Philip Glass, and it incorporates choral interpretations of Hopi end-time prophecies, which include several events illustrated in the film. The chants are translated as saying, "If we dig precious things from the land, we will invite disaster. And near the day of purification, there will be cobwebs spun back and forth in the sky. And a container of ashes might one day be thrown from the sky, which could burn the land and boil the rivers." The final sequence of the film shows footage of a rocket lifting off and exploding after a few seconds, and the camera follows the flaming rocket engine and a white vapor trail against a blue sky as the debris plummets toward the ground, reflecting that prophecy. According to Hopi tradition, there will be a total of 9 worlds, each one successively destroyed as punishment for human transgressions. The first world was consumed by fire. In the second, the globe fell from its axis and the earth was covered in ice. The third was destroyed by a flood. The fourth world is the one in which we currently live. Tribal leaders of the Hopi predict 9 signs that the fourth world is nearing annihilation, because the lives of all people are so corrupted by turning to material things and away from spiritual teachings. And those signs are illustrated in the film. They include the coming of the white man and cattle, described as a strange beast like a buffalo but with great horns that would overrun the land, as well as the earth being crossed by iron snakes, railroads, and stone rivers that make pictures in the sun, highways, the land being crisscrossed by a giant spider's web like the power or telecommunications grid, the seas turning black and many living things dying because of it, like oil spills, and a great dwelling place in the heavens appearing as a blue star falling with a great crash, like rockets or atomic bombs. According to this prophecy, all of the United States will be destroyed except for the Hopi homeland, which will be spared as a refuge towards which survivors will gravitate. The ancient village, or Daibi, is the Hopis' Israel, the center of the world, the last stronghold of our remaining spiritualism, and the site of the world's rebirth. Like the ancient Hebrews, the Hopi see themselves as surrounded by a world lost in spiritual darkness. Once the fourth world has completed its fall and the fifth world has emerged from the ashes, the remaining cycles must be completed before the Hopi reach the world of Taiwa, the Creator. From the mid-1990s to the mid-2000s, a group called the Alliance of Religions and Conservation, comprised of 11 of the world's major faith groups, representing 2/3 of the world's population, developed a book called Faith in Conservation, which contains a statement from each faith group declaring its commitment to ecological stewardship and the basis for that commitment in the group's religious tradition. The introduction to that compilation reflects the imperative of environmental conservation described commonly by all of the faith groups represented in the book, even considering the cyclical nature of life on the planet over geologic time scales, or the cyclical nature of universal expansion and contraction from the perspective of an astrophysicist, and especially considering the cyclical nature of shared human spiritual and social experiences, which are part of and are dependent on biological systems and processes that operate on timescales much shorter than those geologic or astrophysical cycles. Paraphrasing from that introduction, imagine you are busy planting a tree and someone rushes up to you to say that the Messiah has come and the end of the world is nigh. What do you do? The advice given by the rabbis in a traditional Jewish story is that you first finish planting the tree, and only then do you go and see whether the news is true. The Islamic tradition has a similar story which reminds followers that if they happen to be carrying a palm cutting in their hand when the day of judgment takes place, they should not forget to plant the cutting. There's a tension in the environmental world between those who wish to tell us that the end is nigh and those who wish to encourage us to plant trees for the future. In 1992, for example, we were all told in press statements before the event that the Earth Summit held in Rio de Janeiro was the world's last chance to save itself. Indeed, many major reports emerging from environmental bodies paint a picture of terrifying impending destruction in a sincere desire to shock people into action. Year after year, these groups have been gathering information that shows beyond reasonable doubt that parts of our living planet are slowly but surely being diminished, polluted, fished out, hunted to the edge, built over, cut down, erased, or simply lost. It is increasingly clear and still shocking that human activity, increased global warming, is responsible for destruction of many core species in the seas, the destruction of entire forests within a single generation, and the accelerating spread of deserts. Around the world, hundreds of organizations chart, report, and analyze the declining wealth of our world and urge urgent action on anyone who will listen. Such groups often fall back on the vivid language of biblical or Vedic accounts of the end of the world, apocalyptic imagery that encapsulates our deepest terrors more graphically than any chart or statistical breakdown can ever do. Powerfully emotive language is used to make us feel that we are sitting on the edge, that in the words of the Jewish story I just told, the end of the world is nigh. The blurb describing my talk in the Fellowship's weekly announcements listed a few of the insults we've heaped on the planet, calling them an existential threat. And I think some folks might have found that terminology a little overly dramatic, but I'm reassured that it's an appropriate description given the rising chorus of dire assessments of our trajectory, most recently topped off by statements from the U.S. military describing the national security threat represented by climate change, and by Pope Francis just last week calling on Christians to safeguard creation and warning that if we destroy creation, creation will destroy us. He also argues that environmental crises are connected to economic justice and are largely the result of a wealthy minority exploiting the planet at the expense of the poor. He said, and this mirrors the Hindu reading that I made at the beginning of the service, creation is not a property which we can rule over at will, or even less is the property of only a few. Creation is a gift. It is a wonderful gift that God has given us so that we care for it and we use it for the benefit of all, always with great respect and gratitude. Paraphrasing again from the Alliance of Religions and Conservation, if the environmental crises facing the world today were simply a matter of information, knowledge, and skills, then we would be heading out of these dangers. For more than 30 years, the world's major institutions, scientists, and governments, and some of the largest non-governmental organizations have compiled and analyzed details of how we are abusing the planet. Since 1972, huge conventions have brought these people together to discuss the state of the world. Each year, the World Conservation Union publishes its red data books, chronicling the loss of species and habitats in great detail. Today, we can discuss the issues of global warming in very specific terms. Charts show the destruction of tropical forests and the loss of crucial habitats around the world is described in books and papers and films, yet the crises are still with us. The simple fact is that knowledge on its own is not enough. All this information has to be set within a wider framework to make much sense. Take the case of the destruction of tropical rainforests. At the first major United Nations meeting on the environment held in Stockholm in 1972, scientists and environmentalists made powerful presentations on the fact that many countries were selling their rainforests for cash for reasons of poverty as well as opportunism, only to find themselves left with eroded and impoverished soils. The experts presenting the case assumed that their audience would share their concern at this loss and stop the deforestation. But that was not the framework within which everyone was listening. A number of politicians and business people went home to their developing countries and informed their superiors that apparently there were groups who would pay good money for all that rainforest. And the rate of destruction of the rainforests rose perceptibly after Stockholm. This was partly because the meeting had opened some people's eyes to the commercial potential of forests. Both politicians and environmentalists had the same data, but they had different assumptions, different values, different frameworks. I see ecologically destructive behavior or actions to be an external manifestation of an internal disconnectedness or dissociation from the world around us. The kind of experience of and connection to the natural world that Carla and Rick described the last couple of weeks is like preventive medicine against this disconnectedness. By the same token, I see ecological conservation work as a means of restoring the world around us and ourselves as well. As a society, we seem more intent on unsustainably degrading the environment upon which we depend in service to a level of consumption that does not achieve any improvement in standard of living or fulfill any spiritual need. This concept is reflected in the invocation from the reading before my talk for a mind based on Dharma, and I didn't give you that, so let me give you that now. So this is from Patrul Rinpoche. It's from the words of my perfect teacher. It says, base your mind on the Dharma. Base your Dharma on a humble life. Base your humble life on the thought of death. And base your death on a lonely cave. Uplifting. A little thought for you. The invocation from my reading before my talk, for a mind based on Dharma and a Dharma based on a humble life. The music that you heard during the offering is known as a Kecak chant, which was originally part of an Indonesian trance dance performed to ward off evil spirits or diseases, and it's been incorporated into performances of the final battle described in the Ramayana between Rama's monkey army and the demon army led by Ravana, and I'll give you a little background here about all of that. The Ramayana epic is interpreted a little differently between Hindu and Buddhist and Sikh and Jain traditions, but in all of them it explores the concept of Dharma, which is variously interpreted as duty or right living or cosmic law and order. It depicts duties and ideals of human relationships. With the help of the monkey king Hanuman, who symbolizes pranayama or the rhythmic breathing, Rama finds the location of his abducted wife, Sita, who represents Kundalini, or cosmic energy, and conveys the news of Rama, the self. Rama's defeat of Ravana, Sita's abductor, symbolizes the destruction of ego, which manifests activity, malice, and ignorance, and this allows for self-realization. The union of Rama and Sita is the union of cosmic energy of the universe with the eternal consciousness of the true self. That cosmic energy is called Shakti, which is understood to exist in a state of, I can hardly say this, Svatantriya, or being interdependent with the entire universe. Does this sound familiar? It sounds to me like the aspiration of the seventh UU principle of respect for the interdependent web of existence of which we are a part. This concept of environmental stewardship as a means to self-realization is reiterated by the Alliance of Religions and Conservation. Ultimately, the environmental crisis is a crisis of the mind, and likewise, appropriate development is ultimately an appropriate development of the mind. We see, do, and are what we think, and what we think is shaped by our cultures, faiths, and beliefs. We all want to change the world for the better. The question is, whose world is it, and how can it be changed? We live in many worlds. Take the example of a fox. What do you think a fox is? Our answer has to be, it depends on what you believe. This is true of everything around us. We understand things because of what we believe. If you believe that hunting is wrong, you will see animals such as the fox, tiger, or bison in one way. If you are a hunter, then you will see them in a different way. If you like sausages, then you will see the pig in one way. If you are a vegetarian, you will see the pig somewhat differently. If you believe that the world is there to be used as you want and when you want, then you are not likely to treat it the same way as someone who believes that it is the loving manifestation of a divine being, or that all life is itself part of the divine. What you believe gives meaning to what you see. It determines how you use, treat, and respect the rest of the world. The challenge to those seeking to make the world a better place is how to help different visions and different experiences of the world to work together. If you do not realize there are different worlds, but insist everyone should see the world as you do, you can lose key potential allies who feel their world has been ignored, and respecting other worlds, seeing and respecting other worlds opens up vast possibilities. The living UU tradition, which we describe as being drawn from many sources, seems to embody a means through which these different visions and experiences of the world can work together to achieve those possibilities. And our challenge, the challenge that I would put to you as a fellowship and to myself, is to realize that potential in our community. So, thank you.